wrong. We'll see what happens. There's another three. Good luck with iron. You can make some new business. It's a bit high, yeah. Oh, really? Apparently, yeah. That'd be hard to get. Yeah, that's much better. Very good. Okay. Here we go.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
So this is the third sutta in the collection of the Majjhima Nikaya, and just to pad it out, who knows what the other Nikayas are? Yeah, any other Nikayas? Diga Nikayas, just to be quiet.
Sanyutta
Nikaya. Okay, be quiet, yes.
Sanyutta Nikaya.
Yes, so what's the last one? Over there, be quiet, to this side. Good if you can, yes. You've got it right. Okay. So what do those actually mean? Nikaya just means like a grouping. And what does the Digha Nikaya mean? Long, yeah. But are they always long? Because sometimes in these ones they're even longer, but they say they're longish. And the Majjhima, they're the middle. And the Anguttara, they're quite small. But it's also, because the called Anguttara just means that just they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to how many? What's the last one in Anguttara?
11.
11, okay. And we have Sanyutta Nikaya. And what is the Kudaka Nikaya? What does that mean? Sorry?
Little
nose. It actually literally means like little things. It's almost like a miscellany of all the other stuff they couldn't put anywhere else. So because it's got so much other, they've got some really interesting stuff. They've got things like the Sutta Nipata, which is, most people say is really very old. But they've also got things like the Udana and the Itiwutaka, which are not in the Chinese. They look there quite late. And they've got other things such as the Dhammapada. And they've got such things as the Patisamvita Magga, which is certainly very late. So you've got the Kudaka Nikaya. That's one of the groups of discourses where you could actually put things in. So it seems that those are less reliably the word of the Buddha. Because it was a miscellany, they could actually add a few little bit extra bits in there after the time of the Buddha. But in the Vinayapitaka, of all the traditions, when it says that after the Parinibbana of the Buddha, they had the first council, and there at the first council, first of all, the Arahat Upali recited the Vinaya, and then who recited the suttas? Ananda. They actually never said he recited the suttas, they say he recited the Panchanikaya. Panchanikaya, the five Nikayas, which we just talked about. And who was it who recited the Abhidharma at the first council? Nobody. It wasn't there.
According to the Myanmar Phantom.
Yeah, but according to everybody else, no one recited the Abhidharma. It's conspicuous by its absence. So, and this is the third sutta in this particular section. As you One of the reasons I go to this for everybody, so it gives you an introduction to the sutras. And these are 10, there's some very deep ones, like the first one, which I'm leaving to the last. We've got these bread and butter, literally, or rice and curry sutras, which is all about teaching, especially monks and anagarikas, actually to be simple in the way you use these things in this monastery. You've all come here to this monastery, and so much work has gone into this monastery. So many donations, and you just come at this time just enjoying the hard work of everybody else. But how should you treat all of these wonderful resources we have? And this is the context of this sutta. By this time, according to the commentary, it makes a lot of sense. The Sangha was getting very strong, very popular, so the monks were living a very easy life. Nice food, nice accommodation. In fact, sometimes people would become monks just because it was a nice lifestyle. It reminded me that in just Ubon, where I grew up, the first year I was there was the Vietnam War, and when all of the capitals, Laos and capital Laos, Vientiane and Phnom Penh, they all fell. As many refugees came in, especially from Laos, and there was a big refugee camp in Ubon. And many of the local villagers actually went, they didn't try and escape from the camp, they actually tried to escape into the camp. They went under the fence into the camp because they got really nice food there, free medical care, and once they got fattened up, then they would escape back to the village again. And many of them did that because it was very good life in the refugee camp. And same in here, that many people become monks in order to have a nice lifestyle. And I'm quite surprised that's what was happening. It's an easy life. So the Buddha had to give teachings like this to make sure that you're not just a monk just because of an easy life. So with that context, here we go. Thus have I heard. And who would have said that? Ananda. This is actually repeating as he started his recitation. He said, thus I have heard from the Buddha. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Sawanti in James's Grove and Nata Pindika's Park, as we described last time. There he addressed the monks thus, monks. And they replied, Venerable Sir. And the Blessed One said this, monks, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my disciples be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? Because if you are my heirs in material things, not my heirs in the Dhamma, you will be reproached thus. Now teach his disciple, live as his heirs in material things, not as his heirs in Dhamma. And I will be reproached as well. The teacher's disciple live as his heirs in material things, not as his heirs in Dhamma. So have the idea there, the Buddha like being a spiritual father, us as our children, and then we inherit from our father not the material well-being, but the spiritual well-being. And that's always a big problem, especially in monasteries. We try and keep the lifestyle simple, because without that simplicity there's no real practice. And this is emphasizing the importance of simplicity. If it gets too comfortable, it means that the monks and the novices and the anagarikas and the visitors get slack. And they have a wonderful saying later on, they become leaders in backsliding. You know what backsliding means? You're sitting up here meditating, you lean back, and you slide, until you're totally horizontal. You slid onto your cushion, onto your pillow, you fall asleep. That's not what we're supposed to be doing. And the Buddha says, but there's always a lot of repetition, as I keep on saying in the Pali, if you are my heirs in Dhamma and not my heirs in material things, you will not be reproached. As it will be said, the teacher's disciples live as his heirs in Dhamma, not as his heirs in material things. And I will not be reproached. As it will be said, the teacher's disciples live as his heirs in Dhamma, not as his heirs in material things. Therefore, monks, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my disciples be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? So, for those of you who don't know the way this monastery works, we try and keep it reasonably comfortable, but not too indulgent. So, you have heaters in your rooms, so you can use them just to ward off the heat, but if you find you're getting too dull and sleepy, turn them off. Wonderful way to overcome sloth and torpor early in the morning is to jump out of bed, zippity-doo-dah, what a lovely day, and meditate with no heater and no blanket. That will soon wake you up. Because a lot of times people can wake up. I remember this one monk. He had one of these sleeping bags, had a zip in the bottom. He wouldn't get out of the sleeping bag. He just opened up the bottom just so he could cross his legs. Instead of a sleeping bag on when he was meditating. And that's getting a bit too sort of indulgent now, because if you're too warm, you get too sleepy. So I don't mean that going getting cold and flus and things, but so try and make it so you're not too indulgent. And that way that, you know, you can have good meditation. So we have all these, sometimes we think it's a bit too comfortable in these monasteries. So, and those are the lay people, be careful not to offer too many things to the monks. So, you know, keep them a bit sort of on the edge. And the lay people as well, because that way that, you know, we practice rather than looking forward to the next meal. And of course, it's very easy. We can get heaters in each of your rooms, air cons, and some monasteries. Who knows? Maybe you can get butlers. Not just for the monks, but for the anagarikas as well. And instead of just having just a buffet, we can actually have a menu every day, so you can order. But you know, what would that be like? Maybe you're getting too indulgent. So try and keep it simple, if you possibly can. Now, this is an example to Buddha gave. Now, monk, suppose that I had eaten, refused more food, had my fill, finished, had enough, had what I needed. Have you noticed repetition again? Now how many times it's like a thesaurus and an entry, you know, having finished your meal. Suppose I had eaten, refused more food, had my fill, finished, had enough, had what I needed. This is common in Pali, there's so much repetition, where in English we would say one word, in Pali they say six. And don't think that there's some different meaning with these words, it's just the way of speech. So I'd had enough, basically he finished his meal, and some alms food was left over to be thrown away. So even the Buddha left over some alms food, and do it every day. Then two bhikkhus arrived, hungry and weak, and I told them, monks, I have eaten, had what I needed. Well, there was this alms food of mine left over to be thrown away. Eat if you like. If you do not eat, then I shall throw it away where there's no greenery or drop into water where there's no light. That's one of our rules and the sakya, so that the monks would not pollute areas. He wouldn't throw it into sort of like people's drinking water, because they would use that water for drinking, or nor would you sort of throw it away on people's crops. So we must make sure that it's not going to pollute anything. Here in this monastery, you usually put it on the compost. Some monks put it out for the kangaroos if it's deep in the forest, but not out here because it just attracts too many kangaroos and they get a bit aggressive. So that we make sure that even in the time of the Buddha, we're not going to pollute people's water supplies, ponds, or fields where they're growing their rice or their wheat or whatever. So that's one of our rules. But however, if there's like fish in there, which so they can eat that food, then Buddha said, oh, you can throw it in there, the fish are going to eat it. Or if you've got no other place to throw it, you can actually crush up the grain so there's a bit of a paste, and then they can actually go down to the bottom of sediment. In other words, the Buddha was very careful not to spoil people's water supplies. So he asked the monks, you can eat my leftovers if you wish. Then one monk thought, the Buddha has eaten, had what he needed. Why there is this alms food of the Buddha left over to be thrown away? If we do not eat it, the Blessed One will throw it away. So I think, well, what should I do? Well, this has been said by the Buddha. Monks, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Now this alms food is one of the material things. Suppose that instead of eating this alms food, I pass the night and day hungry and weak. And instead of eating that alms food, he passed that night and day hungry and weak. And the second monk thought, the Blessed One has eaten, had what needed, but there's this alms food of the Blessed One left over to be thrown away. Suppose that I eat this alms food and pass the night and day neither hungry nor weak. And after eating that alms food, he passed the night and day neither hungry nor weak. Now, although that monk, by eating the alms food, passed the night and day neither hungry nor weak, yet the first monk is more to be respected and commended by me. Why is that? Because that will for long conduce to his fewness of wishes, contentment, effacement, easy support, and arousal of energy. Therefore, monks, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my disciples be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? Now, this is an example which the Buddha said. Even though most of the time, very fat, the Buddha would offer that food to the monk when he was hungry, because it's important to live a middle path, so you're not sort of harming your body. But even so, every now and again, say no to something. It's important because even though it may affect your health slightly, you're just a little bit hungry, you're not going to die. But at least you know that it's be conducive, encouraging, number one, fewness of wishes. And that is called, you know what fewness of wishes means? The word in Pali, apichato. That's number two muck, fewness of wishes. So it's conducive to having few wishes. When you say no to one thing, it's easier to say no to a second thing, and a third thing, and a fourth thing. When you keep saying yes to something, then you find your desires don't get satisfied, but they get inflamed. That's why just giving in to desires doesn't appease them. It just makes them more demanding. So that's why just saying no to something makes it easier to say no to other things. No. Yes, go on.
I think, you know, like finding the middle path and not the extreme path.
Yeah.
Like being hungry and weak. I think in the Sutra it says past that day, hungry and weak. So is that kind of indicating that was just for a limited period?
Yeah. So you don't do that all the time because the Buddha tried fasting and starving. And that was one of the first things he said when he became enlightened. Don't do that. You can't do things which tire your body. But just going without food for a day doesn't really harm you. Or going out without something for a day. That's actually why the training with Ajahn Chah was quite strict. So, you know, sometimes you did go without sleep. Even though you were tired, and the meditation wasn't all that good, at least you know, it doesn't matter going without sleep for one night. It's not the end of the world, you just catch up later on. Or going without food. Doesn't matter, you can eat later on. And I remember a couple of times, when we first came to Perth. It was only a very few, so 26 years ago, very few people would come and feed the monks. And sometimes what they would do, they'd bring the food, sort of in the evening, they'd put it in the refrigerator. We'd wait for someone to come in the morning to offer it. And we'd wait. And we'd wait. 10 o'clock, no one. 11 o'clock, no one. 11:30, we're looking at that clock, ticking around to 12 o'clock, and still, no one came. We could see it, we could smell it, but there's no one to offer it to us. But of course, we didn't die, it's no big deal. So that's sometimes how we could train. But even when I was a layperson, I remember I had this, I'm just padding out this talk, with a layperson, one of my friends. He was a Christian and I was a Buddhist. We were always making competitions with each other. And so we decided to fast. So we're going to fast for 3 days and see who would win. And I was very tough because I had these, I really like these English muffins in the afternoon with a cup of tea. The layperson. I put these English muffins on the shelf so I could see them every day, but not eat them. And in the evening, this was when I was a student at Cambridge, I'd get on my bicycle and deliberately sort of bicycle past the fish and chip shop just to torture myself. No, I couldn't eat anything. And of course, you know, my mate, the Christian, he only lasted about a day, but I did the whole 3 days. It's just pure pride. And yeah. At least I did. It's no big deal. Fasting for a few days. Yeah.
I just remember now you were giving us this talk about how fasting restraint gives more energy.
Yeah.
My heart may be stronger because I have the habit.
Well, it's exactly what the Buddha says here. It's when you say no to something, you're not heirs to material things, but heirs to Dhamma. You're almost like heirs of restraint, pureness of wishes. Because the craving, the desires, that consumes so much of your energy. Most of the mental energy is wanting something, or wanting to get rid of something. And when you have this pureness of wishes, basically your mind is not consuming energy. So instead the energy is only one place to go, to mindfulness. You don't use up so much of your fuel. So you can go into the mind rather than, I want this, I want that, I've got to get this. You have all this list of things which you want in your mind. I've got to remember to get this and get that. And go here and make this happen. And the fewness of wishes consumes a lot of energy. And also we have the same mind state when we're meditating. Yep, I want present moment awareness, I want silence, I want a nimitta. Come on, I want nimitta. What? And as soon as you get a nimitta, then I want jhana. You're never satisfied. As soon as you get first jhana, can you be satisfied with first jhana? No, I want second jhana. So it's, you know, a lot of times with so many desires, when you have fewness of wishes, you actually go, you have an ability to say stop. It's that what I said, I think, yes, on Wednesday, having that heroic effort of virya, the ability to sacrifice, to say no, to give up, to abandon, to renounce. So that's where the energies come from. So having fewness of wishes is really important. And you all know that story that when I was, this is again how you were trained, a young monk in Thailand, maybe about 3 or 4 years as a monk, really helped somebody out, gave them some counseling or something, and they came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, you really helped me, I want to give something just for you. Not for the monastery, for you. What do you need? And usually in Thailand, it's called the mendicant allowance, it's part of our rules, you can actually save for, in this particular case, like 100 baht. Which was about worth, was it $3, $4? Quite a lot of money. It said, 100 baht for you. Now what do you want? You need to give like an amount so you know what you're talking about. And I was just so peaceful and so happy that I couldn't think what I wanted. And you know what lay people are like? They're busy. They've got to go back to work or something. So I was getting a bit frustrated. I saw that. I said, look, why don't you come back tomorrow? I'll go back to my hut tonight and I'll think what I need. You can come back tomorrow. He said, that's a good idea. Okay, so whatever you want for 100 baht, let me know tomorrow and I'll go get it for you. So I went back to my room and then I started thinking, what do I need? And then actually I looked at my pen. It was run out, so I needed the pen first of all. I actually needed some exercise books. The old piece of paper I was writing on was just a scrap. So there we go, a pen and a exercise book. And it couldn't actually really read because it was very dark, so I needed some candles. And also sort of some matches to light the candles. And actually, they were talking about light. My flashlight was just really just on the blink, and I needed some more batteries as well. And when I started tallying these things up, 100 baht wasn't enough. And I couldn't take any of these things off my list. And instead, I started thinking of more things I needed. Some aerographs. I needed some aerographs in the sense of let us home to my mother. Talk about traffic. My shoes were really falling apart. I needed some new sandals. And every moment, as soon as one wish came in, another 3 or 4 were lining up to go onto that piece of page next. And soon I realized 1,000 baht was not enough. And if I'd have kept on going, 1,000,000 baht would not be enough. At that point I realised what was going on. And I screwed that piece of paper into a ball, threw it into the spittoon. And when that fellow came next day, I told him, don't you ever do that to me again. I was just such a content, peaceful monk before you did that to me. I don't care what you do with that 100 baht, you can burn it or throw it into the rubbish or the down the toilet, flush your chain. But don't ask me again. Because before I had pureness of wishes, you didn't have anything. You're so content. And as soon as I had that 100 baht, all the wishes came through and 100 baht was not enough. So how much money have you got? Is it enough? It never will be enough. Even if you win the lotto and become a millionaire, still it's not enough. So That's why fewness of wishes, when you say no to something, you're actually stopping that craving, that desire. This is really important. So it's a bit heir to the Dhamma. Be someone who can stop your wishes, be few wishes. So as I said many times in the Dhamma talks, so you're following the freedom from desires rather than freedom of desires. The desires do not lead you by the nose, like a person putting a string to the nose of the cow, pulling it this way and pulling it that way. That's fewness of wishes. And of course you can see what comes afterwards. Contentment. When you have few wishes, you're just happy. Sometimes you look, what actually do you need to be happy in this monastery? You've got a roof, you've got a heater, you've got food, you've got everything you'd ever want to live. You've got all this time. You don't have to go to work, don't have to fill in forms, you don't have to drive through the traffic unless you're taking one of the lights out somewhere. You've got so much time, it's so rare to have this amount of time. And it's not unlike one of these formal retreats where you're told what you're supposed to do. You've got the freedom to make your own schedule. So what happens when people have all this time? They start thinking and planning. Because the wishes are still there. They've got the ability to let them go, but they refuse to. That fewness of wishes. And you get this beautiful contentment. You're just happy to be here, you don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world. That's called contentment. So fewness of wishes, let's go desire, brings you contentment. What happens next after contentment? Effacement. Literally that means you've got another sutta called effacement later on. Literally means scratching things out, salaka. And for those of you in Sinhalese, what's the word for secretary in Sinhala?
Leka.
Yeah. You know what that is? Because Baker was scratching. And the way that people would make the palm leaf manuscripts, they get the palm leaf, they dry it first of all, and they'd actually scratch out the sort of the grooves for the letters. And then they'd put sort of the ink, some sort of resin in there, and then they'd wash it all off. And so that's the ink would go in the holes in the grooves and the scratches. And so that's why her writing was called Lekha, scratching. And why a secretary, even in Sinhala today, is called Lekha. Literally means a scratcher. So if any of you are secretaries, you know, you're a scratcher. Yeah? Yeah, you keep on practicing the ability to say no and no and no no. Say no to your desires. Not to your duties, keep your duties, but say no to your desires. Aha! Is there such a thing as a wholesome desire? There's too much building in the monastery. And I'm the first to admit that. So you do your duties, but sometimes you think, wow, how many desires have I got? Isn't it nice to say no to them? So it's more wholesome to say no to your own desires. If somebody asks you to help, yeah, that's their desire, you can go and help. If it comes from you. For those of you, we've got all these ideas of what to do in this monastery. There is one rule in this monastery. If you have an idea to start a project, you have to do it. In other words, if you think it's a wonderful idea we clean the windows, if it's your idea, you have to do it. It's always really good in communities, because a lot of times people get all these ideas of what they think they should do. Let's build a new building, or let's build a new path, let's have a new compost pile. If you come to me or Ajahn Bhamai and say, I think we should have a new compost pile, you've got a great idea. How you do it. It's stopped a lot of ideas. Yeah?
When it says that wholesome desires, it seems as though that the experience of simplicity is actually to be an experience rather than an idea, it actually has to be free of the ideas or free of the desire for it, and actually just live. Is that right?
I don't know, I didn't understand it. But never mind, I can pick up sort of understanding to be really wholesome. The wholesomeness actually is in the context. So in the context of nirvana, then all desires are basically unwholesome. In the context of like doing good things in the world, then yeah, building a monastery is one of the most wholesome things you could do. So it really depends. I call it skillful instead of wholesome. And I like the word skillful because it's skillful to do what? So it's really the skillful. It's skillful in the context of what you hope to achieve. So you can say like a cricket player is very skillful if he can spin the ball or he can hit the ball for six. It's a very skillful cricketer. You wouldn't call that skillful in the Dhamma. So skillful in the Dhamma is if you can let go of as many desires as possible and stop. So, and it pays me. So it's scratching out our defilements by the contentment. And it's interesting here, fullness of contentment is placement, easy support. And I think all of you, you know, especially you ladies here, you've come to this monastery, friend. How many years have you been supporting this monastery? And sometimes, if there's any monk who keeps coming up and saying, oh, Prem, can you get this for me? Or Prem, can you do that for me? Or Prem, can you do something else? After a while, you won't want to come anymore. Because the monks are just always asking, they're too hard to support. And there's one classic case of these monks, and they were always asking for things. When any layperson came by, you know, they would say, no, we need something. So, for example, you say, oh, you know, I need some more stamps. You know, I need some more pens. I need some more sort of shoes. I need this. Can you get me this? Can you get me that? And soon the lay people were so afraid of seeing a monk that apparently when they saw brown cows in the distance, they would run indoors, shut the windows and hide. And that's actually what happened in the super because they're afraid we might come to ask them for things again. So because of that, because we are mendicants, it's our job to make ourselves easy to support. Which is why you don't ask for things, at least I don't. And we try and make that. Ajahn Chah kept on that we don't ask for things. It comes, it comes. If there are donations, you build. If there's no donations, you just live simply. If there's food, we eat. If there's no food, we just meditate. We don't ask for things. That's why a lot of times people actually give a call. And they say, you know, we're just bringing dharma tomorrow, what do you need? And you know, if I answer that telephone, I say, go and talk to the Anagarikas. But don't talk to me. And if you're an Anagarika down there, they ask you. Don't think, whoopee, now what do I really want? So, you know, don't think what you want, think what other people need. So, you know, keep it very simple as well. That's why also on that board over there, we only have like three items. You still keeping that rule down there? Okay, because I instituted that because after a while, a whole list of things, the whole board was filled up with a piece of paper at the bottom for the extension. And that's not being easy to support. So we keep it just three things. So you have to think about what's really important.
Mm. John, when that boundary is crossed and people become afraid of wanting, people wanting to want, how is that trust really established?
Oh, it's just usually that. Actually, in that rule there, that sometimes the monks had to be sent away to another place because they destroyed the faith of the lay people. And that's something which is really bad karma. Poor monk, that's one of the worst things you can do. You know, these people there have been really faithful Buddhists, and because of your bad actions, always being demanded, you destroyed their faith. And, you know, there are monks like that in Thailand and Sri Lanka, as you know. Many people, you know, tell me that when they say in Thailand they would never sort of go to monasteries because they weren't respectful of monks anymore, because the monks always ask you for too much and they live too well. And they come here and they see like the monks, even myself, you know, sometimes even working. They're doing physical labour. We've never seen like a senior monk doing anything like that in Sri Lanka. No, you see monks working in Sri Lanka? In the forest monasteries, I think. So it inspires people to see monks working like that. Yeah? So it's important that we're sort of simple and we be a good example, not being demanding in nature.
If there are any of you like sending monks away, that's a really big barrier that must have been established there.
Oh yeah, because part of our job is not to go door to door to convert, but at least to inspire people. And even so, for those people, if they say no faith, to establish faith in this system. Because they're almost like the examples, what Buddhism teaches in practice. So it's not just what we say, it's actually how we live is important. Now, if you must have wishes, I was commend my robe, which has got patches in it. I don't know how many times people have offered me a new robe, I just put it in the stores, and I'm going to wear this until it falls apart. You've always done that. I mean, you've had some of my old, remember that old towel I have? You still got it. And this old towel is only about this big, which I used to wash with, I dry myself, and it was full of like tears and holes. And I thought, I can still dry my body with it, because it's got a few tears and holes in it, doesn't really matter, you can still dry your body. So I think in the end of it was Ajahn, when I was away on the weekend, he sort of stole it and put a new one in. Because I wouldn't give it up. He said, you're attached to your rag. And I think from this, you got it from the rag box, didn't you?
On the weekend? I can't remember.
Okay, I can't remember.
Oh, and then when it was found again.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Whatever, anyway. But I've got to live like that, to have fewer wishes, to try and be an example as best I can. It's difficult these days, but try. So when you're fewer wishes, then what else have you got here? You're easy to support, and that arouses your energy. Number one, because you're inspired by your own conduct, and other people are inspired, that arouses energy. But it's the type of energy. It's the energy which is born of like fearless of wishes, contentment, giving up things, that easy support, that type of energy. Not the energy of acquiring, like the executive who wants to be rich and a millionaire by the time they're 30. This is like the energy of renunciation. It's beautiful sort of, yeah, let's give up some more, yeah, let's let go of some more, yeah, see how much I can get rid of. And that's the sort of energy which we have.
So it's a bit more just like a mirror of meditation, but just an
experience. Indeed, it's exactly the same doing meditation. The meditation, fewness of wishes. So you don't go in there and say, right, this is it, this retreat, jhana at least. That's my aspiration. A fewness of wishes, just be happy to be here. Be content to be in this moment. Have no wishes at all. When you sit down there, no wishes. And contentment, just being content no matter what you're doing in meditation, how far you're going. In fact, you're sitting here, it's an amazing thing. This is good enough for me, just to be able to sit here. And what else is there? Contentment and effacement. So squashing out all these desires and wishes are easy to support. And the arousal of energy, then energy comes up. Interesting, energy comes up not by wishing, not by wanting things. That's a type of energy, but that's not the energy which is heroic energy. It's the energy of just letting go. Being peaceful and still. A lot of time you get dull at first. Just wait, be patient. And then the energy comes. The energy born of letting go. Rather than the energy born of wanting. And that's how you become the heirs in Dhamma, not the heirs in material things. That is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. Soon after he had left, the Venerable Sariputra addressed the monks. Friends! Monks! Friend, they replied. The Venerable Sariputra said this. Friends, in what way do disciples of the teacher who lives secluded not train in seclusion? So this is almost going on a little bit of a tangent here, but understand that seclusion is one of the most important ways of being heir to the Dhamma. Now, the word for seclusion in Pali is viveka. Sometimes paviveka, which just means like intense seclusion. And, as I said last week, there are two types of viveka. First Kaya Viveka. Kaya Viveka. And what does that mean? That means hanging out in your room, not associated with others. The way we've arranged this strange retreat, it's very little you try and have to associate with others except for our lunch period. So if you want to get yourself a cup of tea or get yourself some supply, you can go in the kitchen any time. The duties which you have to do, you know, if it's cleaning duties, setting up the hall, whatever, you can do it any old time. You don't have to associate with other people. So that way you actually develop this kaya viveka, bodily seclusion, in your room, in your heart, just alone. And of course the other one is Chitta Viveka. That was the name which Ajahn Sumedho gave to that monastery in Sussex, Chitta Viveka. And but what does it really mean? The seclusion of the mind, it means the jhanas. Secluded from the five senses. Secluded from the five hindrances. Vivichewa Kamehi. Vivicha is the gerund form from Viveka. Viveka is a noun. Vivicha comes from the verbal form. Vivichewa Kamehi. The awa is the intensifier, totally separated from the five senses. Separated from, or secluded from, the five hindrances. The Bhagavad Gita is the first chapter. That's the two seclusions. So, here we go, as I said. In what way does a disciple of the teacher who lives in both types of seclusion, maybe he's just gone into his hut, so he's gone into Kaya Viveka, and almost certainly have Chitta Viveka afterwards. In what way, as such a teacher, do the disciples not train in such seclusion? In what way do the disciples of the teacher who lives secluded do train in seclusion? And this is a stock phrase afterwards. They say, indeed, friend, we would come from far away to learn from the Venerable Sariputta the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would explain the meaning of the statement. Having heard it from him, the monks will remember it. And they always say that, word for word. So it's likely they said something different, but you know, that's just the way in part of it. Say, yeah, come on, let us know. Then friends, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friend, the monk replied, the Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, in what way do disciples of the teacher who lives secluded not train in seclusion? Here, disciples of the teacher who lives secluded do not train in seclusion. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are luxurious and careless, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion. So number one, when the teacher tells you to abandon things, you don't. And you are luxurious. And it's very easy. You can see some monks living in big huts and having all sorts of luxuries. And I've been into some of these monks' huts. And of course you remember that one time in my monastic life when I went into Ajahn Chah's hut, into his personal quarters, and to see just how luxurious Ajahn Chah lived. He had generals, princes and princesses coming to offer him things. And there, this famous monk, I went to his room and there's nothing there. Ah, it's just inspired. Can you even visualize it now? Just a mat on this wooden floor and a wooden pillow. And there's a robe, no blankets. A robe and maybe a book on the shelf. But nothing else. It was like no one lived there. When I saw that, I thought, wow, that's a real monk. Someone who really did have fewness of possession. He wasn't luxurious at all, even though he could have been, because he had all the support you'd expect. And the other monks who were nowhere near like an Ajahn Chah, and got so much stuff. You think, gee, you know, you're luxurious. So, you don't need luxuries. And luxurious, careless. It doesn't mean like living without a care. It means like just, you know, being lack of mindfulness, corpamata. And leaders in backsliding. You've got to be careful, because even if you're just a junior monk, still people look at you and they want to be inspired. And if one monk starts to be backsliding, it encourages other people to. So when he does it, why can't I? So you have to be a leader in the opposite. And neglectful of seclusion. Even I had many, many things to do. I still make sure that I have time to be by myself. Which is why that sometimes after the meal I run away. So it's not that I don't want to answer all your questions, but I've got to actually teach by example to be secluded, not hang around talking to people all day. And even that's what the Buddha said. He said he had this way of speaking to dismiss disciples. So we've actually learnt with many, many tricks which I teach the monks how to get rid of people. So when they're talking too much, you do all these little signs, you look at the clock. You only have to glance at the clock, and it's amazing just how well that works. And people think, oh, you must, you know, be doing something. So they just say, okay, I've got to go back now. One of the other tricks is actually to talk about becoming a monk or becoming a nun. It's really good to become a nun. And then people, they get out as quick as they can. If that doesn't work, the last thing is to actually to say about the next project which we do. We really need some donations for.
And then they're out of trouble before you can finish your sentence.
But anyway, those are tricks of the trade. So this is why we're supposed to be leaders in seclusion. And in this, the elder monks are to be blamed for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher who lives secluded, they do not train in seclusion. They are to be blamed for this first reason. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are blamed for this second reason. They are luxurious and careless, thieves and backsliders, neglectful of seclusion. They are to be blamed for this third reason. The elder monks are to be blamed for these three reasons. Now you can see here also that three is a magic number in Buddhism. It's always a three this and three that. Even you can say that six or seven reasons. You know, the luxurious is number four, careless is five, leaders and backsliders is six, neglectful of seclusion is seven. But they all have to make it in three. So the elders, these are the monks who have 10 or more years as a monk. So they're called the careless.
Do you know how the size of a monk's good to you is kind of determined by what the percentage to reach that particular size and not a different
one? Oh, that was the size of the bricks. I suppose they had to get it to the size of the bricks, so the bricks actually imagine they had to cut through the bricks. And that 2.4 is like many sort of pieces of wood at 2.4 long, or 3 meters. They're just like practicalities, nothing more than that. So we went to the hardware shop, it's easy to get it, so like 2.5 or 2.26. Get it sort of to fit whatever was practical, that's all. And it's big enough to get around and get in. Okay, those are the elders, that's the terrors. But what about when, sorry, yes, you've got a question?
Yes, you were saying that when you were younger, you were
thinking
about the case of the other positionship, and you said that that was coming out of pride and ego.
Yeah.
So I could just imagine when to stop desire, like you can either do it just like relaxing together, or you can kind of stop it, but then it seems like you're stopping it in kind of
ego and self. Ego, yeah.
So does that strengthen the will? So how do you restrain yourself?
You've got to be wise. Yeah, I understand. I know what you mean there, because sometimes people just outdo each other. You know, who can do the most fasting? Okay, we have a competition. I will fast for one day, and you've got to fast for 2 days, and I'll fast for 3 days, and you've got 4 days. So who dies first? So that sometimes is competitive, and especially with male. Men sort of in monasteries sometimes can be really, really competitive.
Yeah, and it's hard to restrain without increasing will,
like
without giving your will to restrain.
Okay. You do it out of sort of faith, out of wisdom, confidence, out of just wanting to be content.
Just like relax.
Relaxing, yes. So, those are the terrors. What happens if you've got 20 years as a monk or more? Mahatera. What about 30 years? That's a month. I'm 35 now. Gigatera. So you stop at Mahatera, that's all.
Megatera.
Megatera, yeah. And in this, the middle monks, what are the middle monks? How many years before your middle monk?
Five,
6, 7, 8, 9 years. Your middle monk. In this, the middle monks are to be blamed for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher who live secluded, they do not train in seclusion, they are to be blamed for this first reason. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon, they are to be blamed for the second reason. They are luxurious and careless, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion, they are to be blamed for this third reason. The middle monks are to be blamed for these three reasons. And even the new monks, freshly ordained until their fifth reigns, the new monks are to be blamed for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher who lives secluded, they do not train seclusion, are to be blamed for this first reason. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon, they are to be blamed for the second reason. They are luxurious and careless, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion, are to be blamed for this third reason. The new monks are to be blamed for these three reasons. Even if you're a new monk, you can't just go around and say, oh, I'm a new monk, so I'll just become ordained, you know, what does it matter? No, so you still also have to behave. Otherwise, people see you. You know, when they see you, maybe in a line in a monastery, they can actually tell who's the new monk and who's the old monk. But when you're out and about, people don't know if you're a new monk or an old monk, because we all dress the same. And it is in this way that disciples of the teacher who live secluded do not train in seclusion. And in what way, friends, do disciples of the teacher who live secluded train in seclusion? Exactly the opposite, repetition again. Here, disciples of the teacher who live secluded train in seclusion. They abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are not luxurious and careless. They are keen to avoid backsliding and are leaders in seclusion. So it's, if the teacher tells them to stop doing things, they just do it. They're out of faith in the teacher. And they're not luxurious and careless. And it's beautiful here. They're still backsliding sometimes, but they're keen to avoid it. They're trying not to sort of go backwards in their practice. And they are leaders in seclusion. They inspire other people just how they want to be by themselves. In this, the elder monks are to be commended for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher who lives secluded, they train in seclusion. They're commended for this first reason. They abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They're to be commended for the second reason. They are not luxurious and careless. They are keen to avoid backsliding and are leaders in seclusion. They are to be commended for this third reason. The elder monks are to be commended for these three reasons. In this, the middle monks are to be commended for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher who lives secluded, they train in seclusion. They are to be commended for this first reason. They abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are to be commended for this second reason. They are not luxurious and careless. They are keen to avoid backsliding and are leaders in seclusion. They are to be commended for this third reason. The middle monks are to be commended for these three reasons. In this, the new monks are to be commended for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher who lives secluded, they train in seclusion, they are to be commended for this first reason. They abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon, they are commended for the second reason. They are not luxurious and careless, they are keen to avoid backsliding and are leaders in seclusion. They are to be commended for this third reason. The new monks are to be commended for these three reasons. It is in this way the disciples of the teacher who live secluded train in seclusion. Now, sometimes as a Westerner we think, gee, how repetitive can you get? But remember, this was not just to inspire, but actually to teach people. And so by repeating, it was all very similar to the old form of rote learning. You tell it, and tell it again, and tell it again, and tell it again, until the message got through. And the message does get through. You ask some of the monks here, and we've mentioned those words, the leaders in backsliding. It's almost like part of our vocabulary, because we've heard it so often, it actually gets into you. If you just say it once or twice, it doesn't have the effect of really getting into your brain and being remembered. So all the repetition here is for a purpose. It's a pedagogical device, which means like a teaching device, to make sure that you really learn what's being said here. So it's not just a Buddha wasting your time. It can be encouraging for patience as well. You have to wait. You want to rush off and to see what's going to happen next. But you have to wait and go through all this repetition. It's giving you patience, but also hammering the message into you. Any questions? Okay, now we get the last part of it. And Sariputta is saying, friends, the evil human, the evil is a bad word, it's like papa is the word. It just means the bad stuff, the problem, the difficulty. Because evil is a very Christian word. But it's really very difficult to actually to get a word which means something which is a problem, a difficulty, a source of suffering. So he calls it evil here. Is greed and hatred. And the two of the defilements. There is a middle way for the abandoning of greed and hate. Giving vision, giving knowledge, which leads to peace, the direct knowledge to enlightenment, nirvana. And this is a great series of sayings here, giving vision, knowledge, which leads to peace. In fact, we actually chant this, we chanted it last Wednesday, because it's part of the Dhammacakka Sutta. I see if I can remember it now. Jnana Karani, I forgot it now. Chakra Karani, Jnana Karani, that's Bishop. Chakra Karani, Jnana Karani is giving knowledge, which leads to peace, Upasamaya, so direct knowledge, Abhinyaya, enlightenment, Sambodaya, Nibbanaya, Sangvatati. So we actually chanted that last Wednesday. It's part of the Dhammacakka Sutra. So, in other words, Chakra Karani, it gives the chakra, it means eye, it means like the eye of wisdom or vision. Jnana Karani is more like the insight knowledge is the Jnana Karani. Upasamaya, upasama, literally means this beautiful evenness, perfect stillness and peace of mind. That sama means like even, and upa means like an intensify, really, really even. And you can imagine that like the still water, where there's no waves on it at all, totally still, totally even, glassy smooth. And upasama sukha, the happiness of such upasama, is jhana. So it leads to this upasama, this jhanic like stillness. What's it going to get? To peace, to direct knowledge. We've already got jnana, this is abhinya, which is, now the abhi again, it's like abhidharma or abhivinya. It means like the deepest of those knowledges. And here we get like the real insight knowledges which give you enlightenment. That's what the abhinyas are. And then to enlightenment, sambodhi, or rather awakening, full awakening, and nirvana. What's the difference between enlightenment and nirvana? What's the difference between sambodhi and nirvana? Enlightenment and nirvana. Sorry? You're dead. Very good. So, enlightenment comes first, and nirvana is the cessation, the ending of things. The difference there. Yeah?
What's the difference between the cessation and nirvana?
That's right. Nirvana is cessation. Means many things have stopped. The pari means totally. Totally ceased. Everything ceased.
Is there
nirvana is cessation. Things cease, yes. Cessation. And nirvana is very, very similar. Things have just gone out. Finished. Nirvana can be like a temporary cessation. It can arise again. But nirvana is ceased. Not to arise again.
So
in other words, nirvana is not a permanent cessation. Nirvana is a permanent cessation.
So, an arahant can have nirvana,
yeah. But not nirvana. Yeah. So the cessation is temporary. What sometimes happens to people, they get into deep meditation, and all the defilements are gone, sometimes they think they're enlightened. So some things have ceased, but it's not nirvana, because they come back again.
Mm-hmm.
No, nirvana, yeah.
No.
Usually, you're getting so close, you have to be pretty dumb not to get insights, but some people are dumb. So, but nirvana, the only difference I can actually say between those two words in practice, the way they're used, is Nirodha is like a cessation which is not It's not permanent. It's a temporary cessation. The environment ceases not to arise again. Viraga is actually the process where things are fading away, they're disappearing. So you see, you disappear. You haven't disappeared yet, but you see you're fading away, that's Viraga. So it's like that's the process, and the end result of that process is Nirodha. If that's a Nirodha which is solid, things don't arise again, that's Nirvana. And if it's everything gone, that's Parinirvana.
That's
enlightenment. Otherwise known as awakening. Okay, and what is that little way? It is just this Noble Eightfold Path. That is Samadhi, Samadhi, right view. Samasankapa, right intention. Samavaja, right speech. Samakamato, right action. Samajiva, right livelihood. Samavayama, right effort. Samasati, right mindfulness. And Samasamadhi, right stillness. I don't call it concentration as we know right now. The Eightfold Path. Now, are any members of that Eightfold Path redundant? Can you get to enlightenment with a Sevenfold Path? With a Sixfold Path? With a Onefold Path? Can we not just be mindful and become enlightened? If we could, the Buddha would say, just a Onefold Path. He always said Eightfold Path, which means every one of those eight is important. Not just mindfulness, it's not just even stillness, it's also right speech and action and livelihood. Which is why that sometimes in the West some of these jojos come around and say, oh, just be mindful. You can have sex and be mindful. You can even sort of be still and be mindful. You can do all sorts of scallywag stuff. As long as you're mindful, then you can still be enlightened. It's called crazy wisdom. It really is crazy. It's not wise. So, Eightfold Path, you have to keep your precepts, yeah? Okay, it's... I'd actually call it motivation. It'd be much better. More accurate. It's where you're coming from, rather than where you're going to. But we use those words so loosely. Any legal practitioner knows the difference between motivation and intention. So where is Gavin today? Is on retreat, is it?
Yes.
Okay. So that's in legal, Western legal system. Your motive is where you're coming from, your intention is what you aim to achieve, and basically where you're going to with what you're doing. So here the right intention is where you're coming from. Is it? No, sorry, I got it wrong there. It is the intention. It's thoughts of letting go, thoughts of kindness. Actually, it's both. So intention can do. Kindness is a motivation. But letting go is almost like an intention. It's a bit of each. So intention can be okay. Sometimes people call it right thoughts. Because there's a lot of correlation between the verbal form of intention, which is your thinking, and just what we know as intention. This is how we manifest intention by our thoughts. So anyway, you know roughly what it is. What are the three right intentions, or right thoughts, or right motivations? Vekamma, which, what does that mean? Vekamma means? Otherwise called letting go. And the second one, second right intention, Yavayapada, which means kindness. And the third, in other words, that's the non-violence, non-aggression. And I've made a lot about that because sometimes people meditate with aggression. I'm going to beat down my mind. I'm going to stop all my defilements. I'm just going to stick here, no matter what happens. And that's aggression. That's violence. And that's totally against the third of the right intentions. That's why a lot of times people they're the tough guys or the tough girls that go to these meditation retreats and they're so aggressive and they don't get anywhere. And that's the reason why it's the wrong intention. It's Michcha Sankalpa. Not God fulfilling the second factor of the Mogwe Four Paths.
Shinapa says that it calls non-cruelty, but I think aggression takes into account the internal pulver.
That's right, yeah. You're cruelty to yourself. Or to your mind. Okay. And it's not just greed and hate. They've got these other evils in here. Anger and resentment. Person they managed to have all the pizza today and I never got any of it. Resentment for that. So you can resent other people in this, but that's an evil, so you don't resent anybody in this monastery. Contempt and insolence, envy and avarice, deceit and fraud, obstinacy and rivalry, conceit and arrogance, vanity and negligence. These actually are words, and Bhikkhu Bodhi and other people have a really hard time translating some of these. So I've got my own translations in here somewhere, if I can find the Pali. So what have we got here? Okay, we've got the first two are lobha and dosa, which are very common. The greed and the hate. And the next one's what's it got? Anger and resentment. That's the coda and upanaho. Coda is like a more specific type of ill will. It's really ill will is sometimes even like mental coda when you're really angry at somebody.
You're striking against.
Sorry?
Striking against.
Yeah, that's upanaha.
Sorry, okay.
Yeah. But sometimes upanaha like is even like revenge. Is another one in there. So instead of what we've got here, anger and resentment, it's almost even like you resent them, but you really want to sort of hurt them. Makkho is contempt. It comes like a pride, and you're really contemptuous of other people. You know, what can you do to become enlightened, you stupid idiot? And insolence. Also, another word for insolence there is like being spiteful. So those are all things you should never have in a monastery. So you shouldn't be sort of insolent to anybody. And you've got envy and avarice, issa and machura. Machura is like being really stingy. So just not sharing with other people. And you've got maya. Oh, maya is deceit. What have you got here for maya? Oh, you've got obstinacy. I got that wrong. Maya and Papita, after Machura, after envy, so we've got deceit, Maya, and literally these are like 40 people, and like it's also like a magician, it's like Maya, so deceit, 40 people, and fraud is just again. Straightforward. And obstinacy and rivalry. Oh yeah, obstinacy is tambo, like being a pillar. And they're just so obstinate. You can't be taught. Sometimes there's a time for stubbornness. So you're stubborn against defilements. You stand your ground against your defilements. You're not so stubborn that you don't listen to your friends in the holy life and see if what they have to say makes sense. And we have obstinacy and rivalry. Okay, that is actually Sarambo. And one of the meanings of Sarvambha is interesting one, fault finding. And that's the one I prefer, because fault finding is such a beautiful word. So Sarvambhacitta is sometimes fault finding. So instead of, you say, obviously in rivalry, it's like fault finding. And you've got, I live next to it very easy, mana and atimana, is a conceit and arrogance. Right, mana is the three types of conceit. I am better, I am worse, or even I am the same. And that's actually called that long conceit, when you sort of compare yourself with other people. And that's actually, it's a great teaching of the Buddha. So just, yeah, I mean, thinking your best. In many religions, they say, oh yeah, that's just pride, you should not get into that. And so sometimes, I remember some of these Christians say, yeah, I'm just terrible, I'm hopeless, and I'm a sinner. That's actually, that's also conceit. And that's sort of the, again, measuring yourself. And even like in the West, we're all the same. That's also conceit. You just don't measure yourself at all. So that's the beautiful. Or like those of you who remember, one of the movies I saw was The Life of Brian. And when Brian was asked to say something profound, he said, we are all different. And then this guy put his hand and said, I'm not. You can pick that one out for yourself. But you know, Brian was pretty close. You know, he was avoiding the three conceits. Not better, not worse, not the same. We're just different. So that's the that's the mana. And the atimana, that is actually the word where actually we're deluded. It's you know that a monk who claims that they have like a jhana or they're a screamer or an enlightened, and if they are lying, they have to leave the monkhood. It's a parajapa offense. But they say, unless it's atimana, in other words, a bit of overestimation of themselves. And sometimes that's what we mean by this arrogance, like an overestimation, just get it wrong. So that's the arrogance there. And lastly, the vanity and negligence, that's those ones. Mada and pamada. Mada literally means like being drunk. There's, you know, remember sura merya maja pamada. Negligent and madder is also means to drunk as well. So that, where we have like basically just having no mindfulness and being a bit stupid. And what have you, they've got vanity and negligence. I know, that's right, just yeah, vanity and negligence. It's not really a vanity, but just a bit stupidity and heedlessness.
I just noticed that list of eight is very similar to the to be listed in the Infant Sutta on the qualities that make it hard to admonish your people.
That's right, and these particular ones, they come up in the next suttas as well.
Yeah.
So these are some of the sort of defilements. But of course they're not exclusive, there are other defilements not mentioned in here. They give you some clue about what is the negative emotional traits of a human being, character traits of a human being. And the Eightfold Path abandons these. So if a person is enlightened, they don't have these things. They don't have anger, resentment, contempt, and insolence, and envy and avarice, deceit and fraud, obstinacy and rivalry, conceit and arrogance, vanity and negligence, all these other translations which I've given you. This is one of the reasons why we can actually see if a person is an arahat or not, even if they're a non-return. So don't just judge them, you know, by their reputation, or just by what a great Dharma discourse they can give. You just check out their character to see whether they have this pride and arrogance and stuff. So if you see anyone come to us and say, I'm more enlightened than you are, I'm more an arahat than you are, then of course you know they're not. Okay. So, let's see. What did I get to? Okay. So the way to overcome all these things, there's a middle way for the abandoning of all these things, giving vision, knowledge, which leads to upasama, peace, to direct knowledge, abhinya, to enlightenment, to nirvana, and what is that? middle way, it is just this noble eightfold path, that is right view, right intention or motivation or thought, right speech, action, livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness and right stillness. This is the middle way, giving vision, giving knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment in the Nirvana. That is what the Venerable Sariputta said, and the bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. So that's the particular suit. Yes? You satisfied?
After listening to the talk, I noticed that because I was very flat, my mind, after listening to it, came more, okay, I'm going to restrain things.
Yeah.
So the arrow now is that skill of my sense of following it before. I was like, oh, I'm too cold and this, and I'm going to.
No, it's good.
Top it out. Is that an okay thing to follow up a little bit less?
Top it out a little bit and see the results. And just like the simile of Sona, if you're doing too much, too hard, it's just like the guitar strings, too tight. You just don't get this feeling of like peace, stillness. If it's too slack, again, it's like the guitar strings are too slack and you can't get any sound at all. And it is the skill coming from your mindfulness, you understand this, how much to push and how much to let go and relax. It's just that right sort of pitch. It's a difficult thing for you to get at first. But with practice, just like a professional musician, they can just book a guitar, just one trick, and then know. And it's all picked up. Even for me, I have to do it and check with this and check with that, because I'm not a musician. So this is actually how you can actually check and tune the mind. So it's just the right amount of slackness, just the right amount of that.
Then, can like the feelings behind your thought, if they are being sustained in that good environment, can that be like a marker that you are kind of finding with it?
Yeah, because that always works. The right intentions, from intentions or thoughts, motivations, that's the source of things, that's the ground of things. So if they come from the right place, then you have to go to the right destination.
If you're not torturing your body, you can have a kind attitude towards it.
Yeah.
And if you're torturing it, you can't see how you can be kind.
You can't be kind. But if you're indulging it, you're not being kind to it either.
Mm.
So if you speak too much, you're not being kind to your body. If you sleep too little, you're not being kind to your body. Eat too much, eat too little, you're not being kind to your body.
And I guess if one is going to an extreme, like indulgent, I guess you can't, you don't really value the moment.
You don't, no. One type of indulgence is escapism.
So that's sort of like having your will in the present.
Yeah. Okay, that was a very short sutta, and I padded it out quite a lot with stories and other stuff. So I hope you enjoyed that, and it's useful for you. And the next one is a very scary sutta coming next. Fear and dread. That's coming next week. Okay, so are there any... Oh, there's one thing which some of us suggested. When you go on the... especially the leading anagogues on the getting the food after the monks, please make sure there's usually a table leg between you and the monks or the novices in front of you. I could tell that to manners as well, so you're not crowding up next to the monks or the novices. So just give them a table leg for that. Is there anything else about the kitchen business you'd like to clean up or anything else? Okay, we're all getting up to eat. You're not backsliding? No, very good. We have our Patimokkha next Wednesday. So